die, Father, is nothing less. Ever since I was a child, I have a feeling of something is missing me. I want to know why I'm here. Can any of us know that? Become yourself. Then God and the devil don't matter. I want to learn. I want to understand. Be careful. Can you find the force to enable these two quite opposite lives to live together in yourself? At any moment, the wolf can devour the lamb. And you must learn what it means to become responsible.
We hope you're doing well whenever or wherever you are listening from. We are available worldwide through our website, redicecreations.com. That's where you can check out more of our previous radio programs, and you can, of course, stream or download whatever works for you. We also have TV episodes. You can sign up for our RSS feeds and our newsletter. We have tons of research material and, of course, a frequently updated news section, among many other things. Today with us is William Henry, an internationally renowned author and investigative mythologist. He's the author of 16 books and numerous DVD programs. William is recognized for his innovative interpretations, continual discoveries about ancient gateways and human transformation. He joins us to discuss his newest book, The Judgment Day Device, a quest for the lost secrets of the throne of the Second Coming, the Ark of the Mahdi, and the Messiah's End Time Kit. He explains how conception of the Ark of the Covenant as a simple golden box is incomplete. We'll also discuss how, while Christians seek signs for Jesus' second coming, the Jews await the Messiah, and the Muslims await the 12th Imam, or the Mahdi. A powerful device with an unearthly power is awaiting to be discovered by one of them. Stay with us to find out more. All right. Welcome back, William. Thanks for returning to the program. First of all, it's always exciting to have you with us talking about your work. So welcome back.
It's a pleasure to be here, Henrik. Thank you for having me.
You bet. So in your latest book, The Judgment Day Device, a very interesting read, by the way. You tied together a lot of interesting threads that I'm eager to discuss with you in more detail here as we go through the day here. But let's set the stage for our audience first and talk about what we could call one of the main components of the Judgment Day device, the Ark of the Covenant, a symbol and or actually an actual item, a device that you've returned to, of course, in many times in your work, William. But tell us, in your view, what the Ark actually is and how it differs from the traditional view.
Great question. The Ark of the Covenant, as most people know, and I had an interest, as you mentioned, in the Ark for at least a couple of decades now, going back all the way to Graham Hancock's wonderful book, The Sign and the Seal, back in the early 90s, following the trail that he blazed, taking us to Ethiopia as a possible resting place for this box or container. Then we went through, the Lawrence Gardner years with the Lost Secrets of the Sacred Ark, and we're starting to talk about the Ark in a little bit different perspective, still focusing on it as a golden box or a container. One that, in Gardner's case, has some extraordinary supernatural capabilities. But what really got me going on it is I had heard back in 2012, early 2012, that the Islamic faction, a faction of Islam called the Shia, were looking for the Ark of the Covenant because they proposed it was going to be part of the fulfillment of their messianic prophecy of the return of the 12th Imam, the hidden Imam, who is called the Mahdi. And I was shocked to learn that Islam had an Ark of the Covenant tradition, because none of the best-selling books ever mentioned anything like that. And so I thought that was really, really powerful, and just started pulling on the thread of it. And as I started getting deeper into the Ark of the Covenant research, I realized that there's basically two takes on what the Ark is among specialists in Israelite symbolism. The first perspective is, as I've mentioned, the Ark is considered a simple golden box made by a craftsman at the base of Mount Sinai to house the Ten Commandments. And that's what most people know or think of when they think of the Ark of the Covenant. But what they don't realize is that there are other components that are in the Ark as well. There's the Rod of Aaron, or the Rod of Enlightenment. There's the Flask of Manna, this very mysterious star food or celestial substance. And there's this container or jar that contains a sacred oil that can transform a human into an angel on contact. And so I started working with those basic pieces, and that led me to the second perspective on what the Ark is. Among Israelite specialists, they recognize that the Bible is very clear that the Ark of the Covenant is, in fact, the throne of Yahweh. It is viewed as a seat or a chair, if you will, upon which Yahweh manifests. This throne version of the Ark of the Covenant is completely different and indeed an expanded view of the traditional view of the Ark as a simple container. And that was the starting place for my research into the Judgment Day device.
Now, let's talk a little bit about Moses as well and how he receives the instructions for this, and he commands, I think it's Bezalel that he commands to build the Ark, correct?
That's correct. And that is actually a key part of the story. Moses received on Mount Sinai a blueprint or a pattern for the construction of the Ark of the Covenant that was to be a duplicate of the heavenly original. So this tells us two things right away. One, there's at least two Arks of the Covenant, an earthly version and a heavenly version. And this encourages us to follow that ancient Hermetic law, as above, so below, and perhaps even to extend that to say, as above, so below, as within, so without, as indeed the law continues. So we're talking about an Ark that has a physical manifestation, but also may have an anatomical or an inner manifestation as well. But back to the point of Moses receiving the pattern or blueprint for the Ark, something very incredible happened during this time. One, Moses didn't understand this pattern or this blueprint for the Ark or even for the other implements that were in the Ark. However, the Israelite craftsman, Bezalel, did. He understood it because he had received what we today would call a download from God. God transferred to Bezalel wisdom, holy wisdom that made him a man of light, either a gleaming, glowing being, as Moses was also described as glowing, or a man of light, meaning he's a man of wisdom. This raised an incredible question in my mind, and that is, why would God download the holy wisdom of the universe? It's thought to be actually the wisdom of how the universe was created. Why would God download this wisdom to Bezalel if he was going to craft a simple golden box? To me, this is a tip-off that something more profound is going on with the Ark of the Covenant than perhaps we've previously ascertained.
It's really interesting. Well, let's talk a little bit about what they used the Ark for as a tool. I mean, it's helped the Israelites in different situations. It seems to be some kind of weapon almost, some people have speculated. What do you think about that?
It's been described as a palladium. And remember, this is an important point to make here. The Ark of the Covenant is the sign or symbol of Yahweh, the Old Testament God. It is also his seal. And when this Ark device, as I call it, is present, it has enormous power. And I prefer to call the Ark a device, as in the Judgment Day device, because the word device means a sign, a symbol, a tool, and an appliance. And indeed, the Ark of the Covenant functioned on all of those levels. It was a sign. It was a symbol. It was a pattern, a blueprint, a consciousness device. It was actually a tool or an appliance. When the Israelites carried it, it does in the descriptions of it in use does infer that it could have been used as a palladium, as a weapon system, as a sign or symbol of the power of Yahweh that promised military victory, just like carrying a battle flag or a standard as a palladium in other military circumstances. Additionally, the Israelites used the ark to part the Red Sea.
Yeah.
That's an incredible feat. I mean, what are you talking about there? I mean, that this ark has the power of manipulating matter, of causing a sea to part? What are we talking about there? Are we talking about, again, following the as above, so below law, are we talking about the earthly sea, the earthly Red Sea, or are we talking about a heavenly sea, as in opening up a hole in the fabric of space-time through which a person could cross over the heavenly ocean or the cosmic ocean?
Let's talk, William, about who is seeking it at this point, and if you think that there are the device, the ark actually is on the earth at this stage. As you said before, we had the Axum Trail in Ethiopia. Graham Hancock followed up on there. Some people say it's in Washington, D.C. There are a number of other places, Yemen, et cetera, et cetera. There is a possibility that there actually are several, as you said before, like three actually in total. And if so, do you think that they're still remaining on that place? Or again, are we talking more about something etherical, something non-physical?
Well, I think that it's important to consider it on all levels, as an ethereal device as well as a physical device. The Ark of the Covenant as a pattern promises great power to whoever can reassemble its pieces. And if we're looking for the Ark of the Covenant out here in, say, Ethiopia or the U.S. Capitol or some of these other places mentioned, then we're looking for a physical device. But what has to be factored in always is that the ark is a symbol for higher consciousness. And this is what I refer to as the kit, the messianic kit, or indeed the complete judgment day device. What has to happen is we must realize that the Ark of the Covenant is sort of a table or platform upon which the Rod of Enlightenment is placed, and then the two tablets of the law, the tablets of the Ten Commandments, are placed on top of that, and then this whole device then produces this sacred oil that's capable of transforming a human into an angel. This is why it's the most coveted device of all time, because if you're Adolf Hitler, if you're Charlemagne, if you're Joshua, if you're King David, indeed if you're Moses, if you're any of the other figures, including most recently and presently Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the president of Iran, you are looking for this awesomely holy device because it can make you holy on contact. And what they ultimately must know, as I realized in doing the research in the book, that these components of the Ark are within us. The Ark of the Covenant itself is our lower energy centers. The Rod of Enlightenment that's placed on top of the lower energy centers is our spinal cord. The two tablets that are placed on top of that Rod of Enlightenment spinal cord are the two hemispheres of our brain. And when this mind-brain-soul system is fully functioning, the human is transmuted into its next higher level of evolution, which we refer to as an angel, or perhaps even as a non-energetic but humanoid being.
Hmm.
Or excuse me, a non-human, non-physical, but energetic humanoid type being.
Okay, that's very interesting. Let's take that idea and go a little bit further with that. If we talk about the mercy seat of the actual Ark of the Covenant, mm-hmm. where the wings of the two cherubim meet above the kind of the golden box, if you will, this is where it's said, or between the space is where Yahweh appears, pretty much. This is like a spiritual manifestation or even a physical manifestation of something spiritual. Or do you think we're talking about Yahweh as the as a soul, as the spirit then, if the ark actually is a component of your body? Or what is Yahweh here that is manifesting right in between here in the ark?
According to Isaiah and Ezekiel, who claim to be eyewitnesses of the Ark of the Covenant in function, in use, Yahweh would manifest as a humanoid being, as a non-physical energetic being, described as rainbow-like, with lightning manifesting all around him. So what we're talking about here is the Ark of the Covenant as some kind of a, perhaps what we might even think of as a Stargate device. It seems to be sort of a docking station, if you will, for this super fast moving, high vibrational being who can manifest in the earth plane. These descriptions of the Ark in use, by the way, also describe the functioning of the Holy of Holies of Solomon's Temple. And it's important for us to recognize that this Holy of Holies place was in fact some kind of a portal or a gateway through which beings could come and go. The high priest, for example, Jesus is included in this group of high priests who knew the secrets of the Ark of the Covenant as a throne, Merkaba throne device that was capable of transforming a human into an energetic being and allowing them to then be beamed literally through the stars.
And I've also heard that this is actually about communicating with God. It's a telephone to dial up to God, right?
Yeah, and you can almost think of it as sort of a holographic projection that manifests. And what we have to think about here, remember, Heinrich, there's at least two arcs of the covenant. There's one on earth and one in the heavenly realms at a place called Sion, the heavenly Jerusalem, a place that's populated by angels and just humans who have become perfect. In other words, humans who have gone through the complete alchemical transmutation from a human to our next level of evolution. And this is where I get the idea that the Ark may in fact be some kind of a docking station, or as you're describing here, sort of a telephone connection. There's one of these in the heavenly Sion, and there's one in the earthly Sion. And when Yahweh wants to communicate, he does so through this device, but not only can he communicate as in a telephone, but he can also, it appears, teleport through this device and manifest physically.
And so there's a sender and a receiver, pretty much, as you said. And again, we're back to that idea of it's channeling some kind of energy, a spirit. There seems to be a lot of different things that can manifest. Some people have said that actually it's an early machine for housing electricity, like it's a battery. But because you have an arc of electricity, right? So between the wings of the cherubim, that's actually where the sparks meet, if you know what I mean with them.
Yeah, exactly. And that spot between the wings of the cherubim is clearly described as a portal, because again, it is between those wings that Yahweh would manifest. And in fact, in the book, I show quite a number of examples of art throughout time showing the Ark with the two cherubim on either side. And I actually show how that configuration of the Ark as a throne flanked by two angels was then flipped over into the early Christian imagery of the ascension throne of Christ, where he's literally portrayed sitting on the complete Ark throne, traveling through a gateway or a portal. It's because he was the high priest of the order of Melchizedek, the high priestly order that was responsible for maintaining this device, or actually for assembling this full kit or instrument and then disassembling it when it's not in use, hiding it away, and then going and recovering it. And it would have been at the rebuilt Solomon's Temple in Jerusalem where all of this would have been last reassembled and utilized.
And remind me if I have this right, but wasn't that the Ebonites that actually were involved in this task, the poor ones? I've heard them referred to as before.
That's right. The Ebionites, the poor ones, they're the followers of Jesus' brother James. James is a very important figure in my Judgment Day device book, because he is not only the brother of Jesus, but he's a highly trained initiate who is in fact part of a lineage of initiates who are referred to as rainmakers, who go all the way back before the time of Elijah, back to the time of Moses, as caretakers of this messianic kit of tools that includes the Ark of the Covenant, the flask of manna, the cruse of the sacred oil that transforms us into angels, the rod of enlightenment, and then also the two tablets of the heavenly books.
Now, the hunt for this thing seems to have been going on for a long time. We have movies explaining it, but also we have something that you brought out back in 2003. We have the whole situation with the Iraq war, Saddam being the believed to be the reincarnation of Nebuchadnezzar. Now we have Iran. What's going on here? Let's kind of detail this a little bit and where you think that what this might lead to if either side here, as you said before, we have three different sides you know, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, they kind of want to get their hands on this. What would happen if one of the sides get their hands on it with them?
Well, that's the ultimate question. What would Mahmoud Ahmadinejad do, for example, if he recovered the Ark of the Covenant? As I mentioned, Ahmadinejad believes that he is here to introduce the Islamic Messiah, the Mahdi, who is symbolized by the Ark of the Covenant. This according to the Quran. And the Quran makes clear that when the Mahdi appears, he will bear the Ark of the Covenant as his sign and his seal, his symbol, and it will be taken to Jerusalem, where the Mahdi will be installed as sort of the new global Messiah, at least in Islam's point of view. And Islam will become the sole world religion. Now, this is really powerful stuff because, first of all, most people believe the Ark of the Covenant is a Jewish relic. It's not. They believe that it's the sole property of the Jews. It's not. It actually, according to Islam and other ancient texts, had a prehistory before the time of the Israelites and certainly before the time of the Jews. And so, but still, the Jews believe that they are the inheritors of this ultra-powerful device and they are the defenders of Jerusalem. So when we hear about Islamic individuals such as Ahmadinejad, one claiming the Ark is a Islamic device and is destined to be recovered by the Islamic Messiah and will be his sign and seal, and it will be taken to Jerusalem, it doesn't take much to figure out what potentially could happen if Islam, if Ahmadinejad or other representatives of Shia Islam were to proclaim that they possessed the Ark of the Covenant and attempted to bring it to Jerusalem.
Hmm. Can we, if we look at the origins, can we trace it back to the Egyptian origins again? Considering Moses' background, some scholars suggest that he's more of an Egyptian pharaoh than actually an Israelite, if you will. Of course, he comes from that background, but that his knowledge for this actually has Egyptian roots. What do you think about that?
I'm actually a proponent of that point of view in the book, Henrik. I believe that Moses lived at the time of Ramses II, that he trained at the incredible temple of Seti at Abydos. He knew the secrets of Osiris that were housed in a place called the Osirion, which may well be one of the most mystical and powerful places, certainly one of the most mysterious places on earth. And it was at Abydos, I make the case, that Moses would have learned about the complete Ark of the Covenant, how to assemble this device. Getting away from it as a simple golden box, he knew how to put this kit together to create this fully functioning portal device through which, A, one could more fully communicate with the God beings and the divine realm and transform oneself into one of these divine beings.
Very interesting. Now, let's talk a little bit more here about Islam and the variations here of what could happen and why they're, I guess, again, why they're actually are seeking it, and if it can, because there's always two sides to everything. It's it could be used for something good. It could be used for something bad. If this is indeed something that can be weaponized, it's understandable that both sides are, if you will, I guess the main conflict at this stage is between, you know, Israel and the rest of the Islamic world. Of course, we have U.S. backing up Israel, so it's very, very polarized, if you will, in the world right now. And something like this, a device like this, then could actually be what really sparks this fire, if you know what I mean, William. So
it could also unify, though, Henrik, and
okay.
That's my point in writing the book, because clearly our world conflict centers around the entanglement between Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. All three of them expect the imminent arrival of a messianic figure called the Christ Messiah or Mahdi. What most don't realize is that all three are symbolized by the Ark of the Covenant. And the point I make in the book is that we have to learn to cooperate because, in my view, the secrets of the true Ark of the Covenant can only be revealed by the cooperation of all three religions.
Well, that's a positive thing. I hope that something like that would make it happen. Do you think that something, you know, quote unquote, supernatural would be necessary in a situation like this for something extraordinary to happen?
I think it would take something supernatural, without doubt. It would take something that is so compellingly profound that all three would have to just agree, wait, we have to unite, we have to cooperate and eliminate the conflict between all three religions, because that is what's leading us to the brink of literally extinction if we're not careful.
You know, if we look at the word Armageddon, it means Har Medigo, which is the mountain Medigo. But this has been, you know, turned into something else, basically, that it's a end-time battle that's going to occur there. And this is something we do associate with Judgment Day. But what do you mean when you emphasize the word judgment, William?
Well, Judgment Day is the end times in all three traditions. And the word judgment means to align, to balance, as well as to weigh or measure. And that's what I mean when I talk about the Judgment Day device. In addition to that, I call it the Judgment Day device because the revelation of this incredibly supernatural device and the sacred science behind it will be Judgment Day for the present world order, because chances are we're talking about a free energy device, or at least free energy science, we're talking about a Stargate device, we're talking about a sacred science and technology that can change our world in the blink of an eye, and it brings Judgment Day to the present world order. It ends it.
Very interesting. Yeah, that's a different take on it. Now, previously, William, you've written about Zion and the connection there, or S-I-O-N, Zion. But at the same time, we have this connection with this particular device that was formed at Mount Zion. It's almost like we have a as above, so below kind of microcosm version here on Earth, where certain things have been mimicked. It seems like we have a galactic center, and this seems to have been represented here on Earth by the mountain, and it's by the foot of this mountain, Mount Zion, where they actually construct the receiver, I guess we could call it, of the Ark then. And I just wanted to ask you a little bit more about that, of the instructions, because it seems like what you said was like Moses, in a way, was actually kind of well bypassed, right? I mean, we hear that he received the instructions and then he told the builder to do it, but you're giving us a different story there. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Right. Moses didn't fully understand the Ark of the Covenant. He didn't have the mindset to be able to do it. Bezalel, however, did. And the key thing to me is that he's described as a craftsman. When I hear the word craftsman, I'm thinking alchemist, a master of the craft, of the transmutation of one element into another, the transmutation of lead to gold, human to angel. And as a consequence, what we're talking about here is Bezalel possessing an extraordinary state of consciousness. And as I probed into this further, I found that there's in fact good evidence throughout the literary tradition that it requires an advanced human consciousness in order to operate the Ark. You're not going to get within 10 miles of it unless you are a little bit higher up the evolutionary ladder than most of the people actually that throughout time that we know have sought it. This is because your Charlemagne's, your Hitler's, people like that, while they are interested in supernatural power and magical power, they are not advanced beings consciously speaking or consciousness speaking. And that is a key component to activating the Ark of the Covenant, as well as ultimately being able to assemble it.
Hmm. Do you think that this is something, well, let's say Netanyahu or Ahmadinejad would actually be able to pull off?
Personally, I'm intrigued by the possibility that they're even looking for it, and that tells me that okay, they're at least on the first step of the ladder. How developed are they personally to be able to get close to the Ark of the Covenant? I can't say that I've seen any public evidence that either Benjamin Netanyahu or Mahmoud Ahmadinejad are of a caliber of esoteric initiate like I'm describing here, or advanced in consciousness enough and able to be able to manifest the Ark. That doesn't say that they're not on the path, or that they have people within their circle that are on that path, and they must know. I mean, here's my take, Henrik. Mm-hmm. I've been doing this research for 20, 25 years now, and it's led me to these conclusions about the Ark, which, again, I've documented in the book and backed up with literary as well as artistic traditions that say this is what we're actually talking about with the Ark, is this super advanced consciousness device. So if I've come to these conclusions doing research as an individual with limited resources, What did Saddam Hussein, as you mentioned, learn about it? With the right. unlimited resources and the ability to access certain sites. I mean, Saddam Hussein believed, as you noted, that he was the reincarnated biblical king Nebuchadnezzar, the last person, according to the Bible, to possess the Ark of the Covenant. And people who have profiled Saddam, as have I, believe that Saddam absolutely knew he was Nebuchadnezzar. He certainly believed it and knew it. And he was out to outdo what he had done in his previous life. He must have been seeking the Ark. I can't say if he was successful in retrieving it, but I know that he was certainly on the path towards recovering it.
And we have Iran. I mean, it's an old civilization. We're talking basically about the Persian civilization goes back, you know, thousands of years. And again, there must be an incredible amount of esoteric knowledge hidden there. I mean, and this is something we don't hear much about. We don't know what they're looking into, if there are any secret societies or esoteric groups in Iran that are, you know, fully versed in this stuff. We don't know.
Right. And my feeling is that if you're looking for the Ark as a simple golden box, you're not looking for the complete device. But I'm convinced that Ahmadinejad, Saddam, maybe even Netanyahu do have awareness that the Ark has these elements or pieces that must be assembled, and it requires an advanced consciousness in order to do so.
So are there any other pieces to the whole Judgment Day device? We talked about the Ark, the rod, and the law text, what more is part of this?
Well, that's a wonderful question, and actually that's the question that is the power pack behind the Judgment Day device, because I had known since the 90s about this messianic kit. I mean, Jewish legend says that when the Messiah appears, you will know this figure because he's got a to-do list. He's going to go get the Ark of the Covenant, get the flask of manna, the cruse of anointing oil, the rod of Aaron, and assemble this kit and use it to teach the secret of redemption, which is how to transform a human into an angelic being, superhuman, next level human, whatever term you're most comfortable with using. So I knew about these pieces for a long time, and then at the end of my book, The Secret of Sion, I began working with these really strange, to me at that time, Russian Last Judgment images. These were images that were created in the 14th through 16th century, and they show this amazing imagery of Christ enthroned in the heavenly Sion, and they show several zones or tiers in these paintings that indicate levels indicate levels of vibrations or levels of existence. They show on the bottom row the earth plane, then they show us moving up into higher zones, all the way going up to the throne of Christ. Linking the throne of Christ, the heavenly throne, with the earthly plane are these serpents that are described as these the Mayans called them serpent ropes. The Russians described them as serpents that were actually almost like cosmic toll booths. And the picture that emerges from these images, and I've got half a dozen of them in the Judgment Day device, is that there's some kind of an umbilical cord, a transportation system even, that links the earthly Sion and the heavenly Sion. Then in the mid-range of these images, invariably in these Russian Last Judgment images, was this strange assortment of symbols. It includes an ark platform. It includes the cross or the tree of life attached to the ark. There's a book. There's very often a footstool. There's a flask containing the sacred oil. And there are other implements, including a robe of light. And as I started researching that symbolism, I said, wait a minute, that looks like that's the fully assembled Ark of the Covenant. That's the Ark with the footstool, which is referred to as the footstool of God. There's the flask of sacred oil that we've been talking about. There's the rod or the tree of life. And the book is certainly the two tablets that get placed on top. And that robe that's attached to it, well, that's what's referred to as the resurrection body, or the rainbow body, or the light body, the star body. And so I was really curious about these assortment of symbols. Turns out what I was looking at is called the etymesia in Greek. It's referred to as the etymesia, or the throne of the second coming.
Hmm.
And I'm like, wait a minute, the throne of the second coming? Yeah, that's right. I mean, a lot of millions of people believe there's going to be a second coming of Christ. But what they don't realize is that there is a prepared throne for this Christ or Messiah figure, and it includes the Ark of the Covenant with the flask of the sacred oil, the jar of the sacred oil, the robe of light, the book of the law, the tree of life, which we think of as the cross, and other tools or implements. And like, there it is, right there. This is the complete throne of the second coming. This is the device that will be assembled by the Christ or the Messiah and is the sign and seal of this figure. And guess what? The Islamic Mahdi will also be symbolized by this very same device.
So to you, William, is the Christ, the Messiah, and the Mahdi, is that the same character, or are we talking about different characters?
I ended up having to hyphenate the name, Henrik, in the book. I just go Christ hyphen Messiah hyphen Mahdi, because I it does appear we're talking about the same figure. Although Islamic prophecy says that when the Mahdi manifests on earth in the end times at Judgment Day, he will have an assistant, Jesus. So they seem to differentiate the Mahdi and Jesus, giving Jesus what we might think of as a lowly status as the assistant of the Mahdi.
And so incorporated into this, we have prophecies, end time prophecies about the Antichrist coming as well and being this grand, you know, unifier of religions and everything as well. And so one level of interpretation that might happen here is that this character, if it is, you know, physical being as such that would appear, would potentially by a lot of people, a lot of Christians in a way, actually be seen as an Antichrist, right?
You're absolutely right, Henrik. The Antichrist is the one who will sit on the throne and proclaim himself God. And the throne that we are talking about is the Adamantia, the complete Ark of the Covenant, the golden box with the footstool, the tree of life attached, or which is the rod of enlightenment, the book, the robe of light. That is the throne that the Antichrist assembles and sits on.
That's kind of spooky.
It's very spooky. And as you get into this, it kind of plays mind games with you, because you have to pull back. I had to pull back on the Antichrist aspect of it. I just wanted to document that here is this throne and attach it most closely to the Christ, Messiah, and Mahdi, but recognizing, and I will be following up on this more in future articles, that this could also be interpreted as the throne of the Antichrist, and or certainly that the Antichrist figure, as some people perceive him, and we don't know all the details about this figure, but one of the things the Antichrist will do will be sitting on this throne.
There's a problem here within the scripture, within the tradition and the prophecy, because there is no way out of this. I think we've talked about this before, William, but basically we're looking at a scenario where whoever would come, whoever genuine they would come to actually unite the world, this would be seen as the adversary, at least within the Christian world. And there's no escaping that situation. There's no way out of that.
No, there's not. And I've been dealing with this question all the way back to my first book in 1996, The Peacemaker and the Key of Life, in which I chronicled the past lives, if you will, or repeated incarnations of a figure who's identified as the herald or forerunner of the Christ or Messiah. I put that book out, and the Christian community all automatically says, well, that good guy you're talking about, that white hat, that's the Antichrist, pal.
Right.
and we hate that figure, and by extension, we hate you too. And so I mean, that's where it just gets really convoluted and confusing, and I just chose to kind of stay out of that a little bit. Now, Jesus does talk about the throne of Satan, which is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And that's worth putting on the table here. The throne of the throne of Satan is, of course, the throne of Pergamon. Jesus is identifying Zeus as Satan in the New Testament, and clearly says that the throne of Satan is the altar in Pergamos. This altar, this throne, exists today. It's in the Pergamon Museum in Berlin. And you can Google Throne of Satan and see the reconstruction of this actual throne that was taken, put into pieces, and taken back to Berlin. Hitler worshipped before it. And intriguingly, and this is just historical fact, Barack Obama utilized a copy of this throne of Satan in Denver, Colorado in 2008 when he gave his acceptance speech in Denver.
Yeah.
The word is that he wanted to duplicate exactly the throne of Satan, but his advisors wouldn't allow that to do a dead-on version of it, so he did sort of a modified version of this incredible throne.
That's pretty amazing how Antichrist slash Christ is, there is a blend here happening from the ancient scripture to these kind of modern, weird kind of symbolic representations that are happening with Obama, for instance, as you said, that is invoking the kind of the Messiah symbolism as well. So how should we perceive this, do you think? Is this a message? Is it just, or is it just the same character, but there is a schism within the scripture because the people who are writing it don't really know who they're talking about? What do you think?
There are missing pieces to this puzzle of the Christ Antichrist question. And I think that's the source of the confusion. We don't fully understand what the Christ is, nor do we fully understand what the Antichrist is. And people try to read the book of Revelation like a recipe book. I mean, George W. Bush did that when we went into Iraq. They're like thinking, okay, the Bible says that the Lord won't return until Babylon's been rebuilt. Well, check, Saddam Hussein did that for us in the 1980s, rebuilding Babylon to the tune of $500 million.
Yeah.
And so Babylon has to be destroyed, so then the Lord can return. So check, let's go destroy Babylon. I mean, this is kind of their thinking in some people's view of how they manipulate world events, because they're reading prophecy in this way. And people have picked up on this with President Obama going back to 2008. He used the messianic symbolism in his New Dawn or New Day logo. He's one of the few individuals in history who is identified by a sign or a seal. It's three rays with a new sun. That symbol represents Obama. It represents hope and change and other memes that are associated with Obama. And people jumped on it right away and said, well, wait a minute. This is getting to be too much, because he's clearly got a messianic complex. People have been commenting on this ever since he suddenly and spontaneously appeared on the world stage back in 2008. A virtual nobody suddenly becomes president.
Yeah.
And people wonder, well, how is this possible? And I even remarked about the symbolism. We talked about the Obama Messiah symbolism before, and I kind of let it go for a while, but then it creeped back up. And suddenly in 2012, during the election, and I speak of Clint Eastwood and his famous speech before the Republican convention, where he in that moment of some people think he was deluded, some people think he was senile, but he went off script. He brings out for his speech an empty chair and starts speaking to it as if the empty chair represented President Obama. He addressed the chair as Mr. Obama. So from that moment forward, Obama, who carries all this heavy messianic baggage, suddenly is symbolized by the empty chair. In fact, after Eastwood's speech, throughout America, there were examples of chairs hanging from trees as if this to symbolize the lynching of President Obama. And everybody knew that the empty chair symbolizes now Obama. Well, the empty chair, as I have mentioned here, is the symbol for the Christ or Messiah. It's the etymatia. It's the prepared throne. It's either shown as the complete Ark of the Covenant or abbreviated as an empty chair. Now, how does this happen, Henrik? I mean, is there something weird going on here? Is this chance? Is it coincidence? Is somebody behind the scenes manipulating the symbolism of the Obama campaigns to match this? Or is there something in human consciousness that's causing us to manifest this symbolism? Is there a desire, as there was in 2012, for a doomsday, judgment day, big wow event? I don't have the answers. I'm just pointing out that the symbolism is there, and it's very specific, and it's very specific to one individual.
Interesting. Very, very interesting. I wonder what if it is the same character? It's just we're talking about the same character in a different time, perhaps. At one point, let's say then that the Messiah is something that changes, or even the Christ, it's depending on who the masses is kind of projecting this onto. It's like an archetypal force. So, you know, Obama in 2008 might have been seen as actually because of, you know, the propaganda obviously behind his campaign and everything else, but nonetheless being seen as a Messiah in the mainstream for a longest time. Now, what if it's turning around? He's going to be seen as the Antichrist. It might be the same person, William.
Well, possibly. It might be just confused. I mean, because in my view, and I hold to this, in Jewish legend, the Messiah, and hence the Christ as well, because Christians believe Jesus is the Messiah. He is the Christ, the Anointed One. In Jewish legend, the Messiah has a specific to-do list. Get the Ark of the Covenant. Get the flask of manna. Get the cruse of anointing oil. Get the rod of enlightenment. And so far, publicly, President Obama has done none of those things. But yet, if he's allowing this messianic symbolism, and I mean, it got so heavy, even one of his staunchest supporters, John Stewart, had devoted a whole segment to mocking his messianic complex. So either he's fooling himself, or people are fooling him by putting this symbolism around him, or he really doesn't know what a Messiah is, because a Messiah and a Christ are very specific things according to prophecy in terms of the things that they will do. Bring peace to the world, bring enlightenment to the world. That's the purpose of bringing this kit of tools, this Judgment Day device together, is to balance the world with a higher consciousness. And so far, we haven't seen that.
No, I was just going to say, laughingly, it's far from it. It's quite the opposite, actually, in my view.
It's quite the opposite. And therefore, you can make the case, well, this isn't a Christ-like figure. This is an Antichrist figure, because he's not doing anything Christ-like. No governmental policies that are Christ-like, no initiatives. Drone killing of children is not very Christ-like. These are things that a president does. And we elect presidents to be president, to be leaders of the country. We don't elect them to be messiahs.
Yeah, that's right. It's almost like there's two different forces here that have hijacked these concepts and are now using them for their own advantage. I mean, if we go back to Israel again, let's talk about that a little bit. They have their various, war projects, or whatever you want to call it, like the latest one, Operation Pillar of Cloud. I mean, they're constantly using these symbolic, programs or operation names, rather. What is that all about in reference to the Ark of the Covenant?
Yeah, I mean, that to me is a clear reference that the Israeli military is trying to invoke the Ark of the Covenant as a military palladium. Not necessarily as a weapon like a gun or a missile, but rather as a sign by calling their Operation Pillar of Cloud. Every Jew, or at least every knowing Jew and Muslim, knows they're talking about the Ark of the Covenant, because this is the energy that manifested from the Ark of the Covenant. It's called the Shekinah presence. And again, getting back to Iraq, when Donald Rumsfeld named the first initiative in our invasion of Baghdad, he called it Shekinah, because the people would recognize the symbolism that we're talking about, invoking religious ideas for military purposes. They do it quite frequently. And part of that makes me wonder, well, maybe they really don't have any of this and they're just trying to pretend, or maybe they do have it and they're letting those in the know say, okay, we're ready for business.
Yeah.
We're ready for the end time Judgment Day business. Bring it on. Let's go. And in fact, that's what we saw last summer, was Benjamin Netanyahu and Mahmoud Ahmadinejad climbing themselves up so high on that tree with their ego and with their blasting all of their prophetic end time stuff, that they were getting ready to provoke one another to an exchange that could have led to a World War III Armageddon type of scenario. Fortunately, they were called down the tree, and are presently, as far as I can tell, not climbing the tree in any dangerous way, but that can all change in a heartbeat.
If we return to the idea of Nebuchadnezzar and Saddam here, this is attributed to other people as well within politics. I mean, constantly there seems to be people who end up in power. They think they're some previous, you know, tyrant or dictator or something like that. But the question is, if they actually, to a certain degree, are kind of I don't know, channeling these ancient forces. They're very, very powerful. They're built up within a culture. And again, they're kind of archetypal, as I said before. And we do have that question there of what they actually tap into. And that could be really, really scary if we think about it, because on our level, it's just two more humans or whatever. But this might be, it's symbolizing a battle, William, that's been going on for such a long time. And that's pretty scary to me, because that means that it could actually snap at any moment, because we're not talking about regular, quote-unquote, rational human beings. They're effectively becoming something else. They've become something else.
Exactly. They're overcome by the archetype. If they are not actually, if Saddam is not the reincarnated Nebuchadnezzar, he definitely was overcome by the belief that he was.
Right.
Spending millions of dollars to perpetuate that belief and doing the things that he believed Nebuchadnezzar would be doing. And on your question, I was in Bath, England back in November, and I had a chance to talk some of this over with Graham Hancock, who, by the way, is also following very closely the Ahmadinejad quest for the Ark of the Covenant story. And I asked him, I said, Graham, when you wrote Sign and the Seal back in 91, 92, did you have any possible conception that it could be front and center in world events in 2012, 2013? I said, would you believe that? He said, no way. I mean, it just was not even in his thinking. But here it is. Clearly, we're coming into a season again where the Ark of the Covenant could be brought front and center into our culture. And this is why I felt an urgency to write the book, because my feeling was, well, if Bibi Netanyahu or Ahmadinejad bring out some made in China golden box and say this is the Ark of the Covenant, we'll know for sure that they're fakes.
Right, right.
Because that's not the Ark of the Covenant. That's one possible component of it. It's kind of like bringing out a keyboard and saying this is the computer. Yeah, well, you left out the computer part of it.
Do you think they would? Well, you're talking about basically, well, they might not even be faking it at that point, but you're talking about something that they're literally kind of digging out of the earth and like, look what we found in our area, whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, look what we found. It was just where Muhammad said to look for it, over here in Antioch. And, oh, what do you know? Here's this messianic figure, the Mahdi. Now we'll proclaim Islam the sole world religion. If you don't submit, you know, we've got a one-way pass to heaven for you.
So this is also, it's psychological warfare on top of it. It's religious, but it's very much psychological.
It's total psychological warfare, absolutely. Because, I mean, gosh, look what happens in the Islamic world when you even think of, when you put out a cartoon of Muhammad.
Yeah.
I mean, if let's say there's a conspiracy among, let's say, a Judeo-Christian conspiracy to say, oh, we've got the Ark of the Covenant, we're going to march it into Jerusalem. Well, Shia Muslims are not going to greet that with open arms, because it's their Messiah that's supposed to do that. So by invoking this symbolism and aiming it at the Islamic world, it's inflammatory to them, and that's where the psychological warfare component comes in.
What do you think would happen if we saw that from the opposite camp, the Islamic world community came forward and said, you know, the Mahdi is here, and, you know, they would reveal an ark?
It depends. If they do that in Mecca, it probably would have one outcome. If they attempted to do that in Jerusalem, it would be World War III. Seriously.
Yeah.
I mean, that is not going to happen, although Islam insists that the Mahdi will bring the ark to Jerusalem. Well, again, that's the trigger for all kinds of doomsday type scenarios.
I mean, you detail as well, William. I think you followed this on your blog, among other things. We have an Israeli, defense. What was he again? I forget what it was within the military. But he basically was calling for a false flag attack on Iran to start a full on war with them.
Absolutely. I mean, and this is the concern right now, is that they want this exchange. And in fact, Ahmadinejad, the profile that I did on him in 2012, which I'm open to revise in 2013 based on any fresh knowledge that comes out of Tehran, but the profile in 2012 is that Ahmadinejad really didn't care if he got a nuclear weapon first, or, which is his aim, as is well established, or if he could provoke Israel to launch a nuclear attack on Tehran, destroying Tehran, because the premise is, from his perspective, is that the return of the Mahdi, and hence the return of the Ark of the Covenant, and by extension Jesus, can be hastened or accelerated by creating global chaos. That's his goal. And so if that chaos is caused by him dropping a nuke on Jerusalem or provoking the U.S. or Israel to attacking Tehran, even with a nuclear exchange, or not, he's accomplished his goal, because such a confrontation would create enormous risk for the global economy, probably collapsing it, further accentuating the chaos, and would certainly cut off oil supplies, which also has deep impact. There's lots of ramifications that we're talking about here that all go towards his ultimate goal of creating chaos to hasten the arrival of this figure. And all the while that he's making these statements, he's then, in September 26, which happened to be Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, the one day when the Jewish high priest would enter the most holy place and see the Ark of the Covenant and communicate with Yahweh. On that day in 2012, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is addressing the UN, calling for a new and perfect humanity and a new age of resurrection, and an age in which everybody loves one another and we have respect for the earth and for one another. And so you clearly get the picture that this guy's talking out of both sides of his mouth here.
Oh, yeah, indeed. Well, that's interesting. And I mean, it goes back to the I think it was called a Yom Kippur of War back in 73. And so everything is timely like this. It's set according to the religious calendar when these countries choose to invade and stuff like that.
Exactly.
Very interesting. Now, William, we have so many more items to discuss, of course. There's so many interesting aspects in the book. We have gotten not even to half of the things here that we need to talk about, and we're going to continue to doing so in the next hour. But I do want to take a few minutes to not only talk about your website a little bit and relay to our audience where they can go and pick up a copy of the latest book that we're talking about here, but also talk a little bit about some of the events that you have upcoming. I know that you have one in May with Graham Hancock and with Lestriever, and before that you have something now in January too. So please tell us about this.
Yes, thank you, Henrik. The book, The Judgment Day Device, which is subtitled Lost Secrets of the Throne of the Second Coming, The Ark of the Mahdi, and the Messiah's End Time Kit, you can get the book at williamhenry.net. It's an 8.5 by 11 book, full color, with a couple hundred or more color paintings, many of them photographs I've taken in my quest for these secrets. It's also available in a PDF format on a CD that you can also get from williamhenry.net. And I'll be featuring information about this in my presentations. I'll be at the Conscious Life Expo in Los Angeles in February. Very much looking forward to that event. And then on into the spring, I have the Path of Souls here in Nashville, which is April 20th and 21st, which is more about assembling the Ascension Kit within ourselves. How do we activate our own consciousness and assemble our own Judgment Day device within ourselves, our own Ascension Kit? So that's going to be a really exciting event. And then I'm very, very much looking forward to the Revelation Symposium, which is also taking place here in Nashville. It features Graham Hancock, myself, and Whitley Strieber coming together May 17th through 19th for a weekend of an unveiling, if you will, of these incredible the incredible secrets of our times and what may be to come.
All right, very good stuff. WilliamHenry.net, that's the website. We're going to have it linked up, and of course check out the books. You can see them right there from the front page. And also take a look at William's blog as well. He's following a lot of these interesting stories, and you'll be able to get additional information there. There's another story here that I want to ask William a little bit later about. They're constantly discovering new things coming out, basically, from the galactic center. New things are detected, these bubbles a while back. Now there's another kind of beams or basically some kind of star power just beaming up through the center. It's really, really trippy stuff, and a lot of these things are being discovered at this particular time as well, which is probably not coincidental. But we'll get to these things and much more, so stay with us, William. We'll continue with more after a short break. at redicemembers.com. We will continue with the second hour with William Henry. When you sign up for a membership, you'll get full access to our archives, and you'll support an independent radio program that is dedicated and passionate about finding answers to many of the mysteries and cover-ups. And we also spare you from commercial interruptions, by the way. In the second hour, William continues on why the Judgment Day device is the most coveted device of human history. He'll talk about the possibility of the Judgment Day device being a relic of an ancient race from a Type II civilization. We'll also explore the esoteric interpretation of Christ's throne, cross, and device, which is also matched with the throne of Buddha and Osiris of Abydos. He connects the throne to the sun and increased solar activity. And later, William talks about the time of great acceleration and the age of personal empowerment. Stay tuned, we have much more to get into.